If you have a green thumb or have always wanted one, then get ready for Garden Talk by Walter Anderson Nursery, hosted by Ken Anderson, along with George Allman. Garden Talk aims to introduce new ideas, help solve problems, and keep you up to date on the latest developments in the nursery and landscaping industry. Now, here's your hosts, Ken Anderson and George Allman.
Good morning, San Diego. You're listening to Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. I'm Ken Anderson, along with George Allman and our special guest, John Clements, a local horticulturalist. We're going to be here for the next hour talking about all kinds of stuff going on in your yard and garden. Good morning, guys.
Good morning.
Good morning. You hit a bunch of farmers markets.
Oh, we did. We stopped and hit one. We hit one big one in Palo Alto when we went up to visit our son, who's at Stanford up there. And it's the biggest farmer's market I've ever been to. The California Avenue Farmer's Market in downtown Palo Alto. I would say it's probably five or six blocks long with a couple of intersections tied into it. And it is absolutely packed. And the stuff that they have there is absolutely, the produce was amazing. But the one thing that popped that I saw, I even sent a picture of it to George because I had never seen one before, was a Tomopan persimmon. Have you ever seen that?
I have never seen one.
It's kind of round, but it has a like a flange on top.
Yeah,
of it.
Yeah, it looks like a persimmon that was girdled towards the top.
Yeah, yeah. It was a very, very interesting, very, very interesting plant. I was really surprised.
Did you purchase them?
No, I didn't because I didn't know.
I would have been curious to the taste.
They weren't quite ripe, and I just didn't. You know, we were leaving that afternoon to come back, so I didn't pick any up. But there was this one farmer there who had these enormous, absolutely enormous heads of broccoli and cauliflower that were absolutely perfect. I mean, just no blemishes on them at all. The cauliflower was snow white, $6 a pound for cauliflower and broccoli at the farmer's market. It's a little expensive.
Were they organic?
Yeah, I think everything at the farmer's market has to be organic.
And pristine.
In some cases it is. There were a lot of fruit vendors there. We actually sampled a lot of pluots. There were a lot of pluots being grown. We bought quite a few. Actually,
I love pluots.
Some really nice ones that we brought home.
They're just harvesting their pluots now. Mine are done.
There are some really late varieties you can get up in the valley.
But more chill hours up there.
Yeah. Oh, right. The chill hours are magnificent up there.
Because we have our low chill three or four that we can grow here.
Yeah.
Right.
Up there, there are dozens of varieties. Sure. And first time I ever had a red Fuji. Now, Fuji is a great apple, but red Fuji? I was at a farmer's market and tried some, and I actually ended up going to a farmer's place and getting some red Fuji to graft on my own apples because it was such a great.
I didn't know there was a red Fuji.
There is a red Fuji, and it's so sweet and crisp and beautiful. Watsonville is a tremendous apple growing area up there. So
one of the things that was really popular at the farmer's market that we were at, a lot of the vendors had Asian pears.
Oh yeah,
and they were just absolutely beautiful. I really like Asian pears. Oh, they don't have as bold a flavor as a regular pear does, but when they're ripe, the texture and the crispness.
Right.
That's one of the things I'm not a big fan about, like Verdun Jouve pears, is they can be, when they get too ripe, they get mealy and soft. And just not a good texture.
No.
But a very good flavor to them.
Well, for us, at least in San Diego area, also the Asian pears outperform the other pears tremendously.
They do.
And that, can I give you a little an edible tip for the Asian pears?
Certainly.
Poach them in a little bit of red wine.
Oh.
First, poach them till they just begin to get soft and you get this beautiful red that infuses the flesh. I usually use a Merlot or a nice jammy cab. And then I make that into a salad with arugula, with the poached pear, and then a little bit of blue cheese or a good Stilton on top of that,
really,
and a vinaigrette.
Good.
Oh, Man,
I will have to tell Melanie that.
Yeah, what a great way to listen to the show.
There we go. There we go.
I want to go back to you going down and seeing oaks, redwoods, and Canary Island palms. And you said that you didn't see any weevils or any damage. How about oak gall? Did you see any galls?
I didn't notice any, and all the oaks were in beautiful condition. I mean, they didn't have any brown foliage on them at all. And they, some of these oak trees were massive. I mean, 3-4 foot diameter trunks on them. I mean, really, really big ones there. And there's a huge arboretum on campus too. Mm-hmm. And that's mostly what it is. They also have a stock farm where they grow a lot of different crops and livestock.
Is it for research or for the labs?
I think it's for school. I think it's for research.
You know, a little trick that's going on now too. If you want to start oaks, the best way to do them, you know, if we always say, George, I know you and I hold this opinion and every good arborist I know holds this opinion. Start with the smallest tree that you can plant. If I could, I'd get my trees in 1 gallons, 5 gallon, okay, 15 if I must, 24, 36, 48, oh my goodness, no. But it's better to even start with an acorn. And all over town, any place that there's Quercus agrifolia, you can go out and collect acorns and start your own
oak trees.
They're all over the place right now. The other little trick I do with those is you can put them in a big bucket, wait for the grubs to come into the acorns and use them for trout bait. Trout lose their minds over these little grubs that get inside the acorns.
Really?
Yeah.
So really now which acorns
tell,
are those?
I'll have to tell my son that.
Oh, agrifolia or up in the mountains, Kellogg eye.
What are those for the people that aren't into the Latin?
Oh, the coast live oaks and also the deciduous oaks out in the mountains. They'll get that little grubs in them.
That was the other thing that they had up there that you don't see as much down here was deciduous oaks, mm-hmm. the big wide leaf.
Yeah,
the wide leaf oaks
and a lot of valley oaks up there too.
Yeah, it's very pretty. But you know, it's interesting when you talk about growing oak trees from acorns. When you go out into the mountains around here, where we have a lot of oak trees, and you walk around, you don't see a lot of oak tree seedlings growing around the trees. So I don't know if they just choke them out on their own or what, but you don't see a lot of little oak trees. Yeah. You see lots of big ones, but you don't see a lot of little ones.
You do see the occasional. I do see them when I'm out there, but you're right. You won't see a mass of them under a tree. Like you might say Colorataria or something.
Or
hundreds of them.
Or Mexican fan palm.
Well, what I will do on my property, if I see manzanitas or oaks that look particularly promising or even pines, I'll actually wrap a wire fence around them to just protect them from the deer and other things, because I want to have that in situ plant that's actually established itself from a seed that will be so far superior.
Much better.
Than anything you could ever plant.
Indeed.
Because that plant is happy in that spot.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. I was talking to Adams about it today, he's the one here in the Poway store that did the fruit tree order for next year. And we've cut back on wine grapes this year. For some reason, wine grapes were not popular this year. So I don't know what the change was, but people shifted away from wine grapes. Maybe they just like something that they can harvest and throw on the table and have a little more flavor to it than not that a wine grape is bad.
I
but
was going
it's
to say,
different.
You know, I have some Cab Sav growing at my other house, and I love just eating them.
I'll eat them straight from the plant too.
Oh, every day.
Champagne grapes, if you can find them too. The little small champagne grapes. Champagne. Oh my goodness. They're so fabulous and great in a salad. Am I talking about food again?
Champagne grapes.
And it's not champagne as in...
Well, champagne's the region.
Champagne is the region. Yeah. But there is a variety called champagne grape you can buy.
It's much smaller.
Very tiny.
It's like the... is it Perlet, the little smaller one?
Even smaller than a Perlet.
Okay, got it.
But they're delicious.
Yep.
Interesting. Yeah. What was the one that my grandparents used to grow grapes? They had... It was a small green one.
Oh, and probably Perlet.
It wasn't Perlet. Oh gosh. Now it's gonna drive me crazy. I'm gonna have to look that up. But it produced far more than we could ever as a family could ever eat. My parents always brought them home. My grandmother always had them available at the house when they were in season. And they had just a couple of vines growing on their backyard in Bay Park, and it grew tremendously. Tremendously well. I will look that up during the break.
there's some other varieties. You know, the varieties that people typically think of as table grapes don't do well for almost all of San Diego, unless you're way east and it's hot. You know, things like the Thompson Seedless or the Red Globe, they do not do well for us. But mm-hmm. Concord does great. There's a variety called Ventura grape that is fabulous on the coast. Perlette's another one. So
Flame does really well. I've had great success with Flame in two locations, in Poway and in Rancho Penasquitos.
No, there's a native grape too that I've seen that Moosa Creek grows, but I don't know what the quality of the fruit is like on that.
Yes, Vitis Californica.
Oh, yeah. Well, that explains it.
Yeah. and it does get fruit, and I've eaten the fruit from it. It's okay. It's not spectacular.
Not great, but it's okay.
But it gets great fall color.
It's a beautiful, gorgeous.
When those leaves turn red in the fall, it's stunning.
Oh, I'll have to check that out.
So sometimes people forget that grapes end up being a really terrific plant for good fall color in our area.
Yeah, they do. You're listening to Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. I'm Ken Anderson along with George Allman and John Clements. We're going to take a break. We're going to be back with more right after this.
There is more Garden Talk on the way. Welcome back to Garden Talk by Walter Anderson Nursery. Got a gardening question? Call 888-344-1170. 888-344-1170. Now, here's your hosts, Ken Anderson and George Allman. I'm out here in the meadow, part of an old stone wall. Stand here because you said so, waiting around and fall. Yeah.
Before the break, we had mentioned you had mentioned oak gall.
I was curious if you had noticed any.
Yeah, I had not. I have not seen any up there.
But we left it hanging as to what is oak gall.
Yeah,
and so I thought we should come back and talk about that a little bit. So it's an abnormal growth on oak trees, and other plants get it as well. But oaks are actually get something that looks like a fruit, and they call it like an oak apple or an oak gall.
Yeah, I've seen it around,
and it's just an abnormal growth that's produced or developed because of an insect.
It's a wasp, I think, isn't it?
For the oak, it's a wasp. Yeah. Other ones, aphids do it, and some mites may do it on other trees, but you see it on oaks in particular with looks like fruit forming on the leaves. It's kind of odd, and among other things. So do you treat it, John?
No. No, it's a naturally occurring thing, and actually I think it's an oddity that really makes it far more interesting.
I was going to say that. I think it's kind of unique, and it's fun to look at.
Yeah. Come to think of it, I think I have noticed that in the oak trees in Rancho Penasquitos Canyon on the trail down to the waterfall.
Sure.
I think you can find it on those trees down there. That's another place where there's a lot of oak trees is in that.
Oh, we just hiked that a couple waterway. Weeks ago. Yeah.
Yeah. There's somewhere down there about halfway between, I think it's about halfway between the old ranch house and the waterfall. There's actually a grave. And
yes, there is.
And it's
on the
fenced
south
off.
Side.
Yeah. And it's fenced off under the oak trees. And Melanie and I went over, we found it, and we were standing there looking at it. And it's kind of under the canopy of the trees. It's a very, very pretty place. And there was something on the other side of the water that was moving through the brush. I don't know what it was, but it sounded bigger than a human being. Wow. And you could hear the branches and the brush crunching underneath of it as it was moving. And we couldn't see it. And I told Melanie, I said, we need to go.
So do you think it was like a mountain lion, a deer, or a ghost, since you were at a gravesite? I have seen.
The reason why we left is because I thought it could have been a mountain lion. And I have friends that lived in Penasquitos that had spotted mountain lions around the Horseman's Park area. So they are in that valley.
They're in that corridor.
Yeah. So it may very well have been a deer.
I've seen a lot of mule deer down in there when I've ridden my mountain bike through there.
Yeah, but it was enough to make me take a precaution to get out of there. But that's a fantastic hike.
That's beautiful.
Especially when there's after a rain.
And you know what's interesting is Capri and I just did it recently. I was surprised at how much water is still in there.
Oh yeah.
You know it was.
There's always water.
We did it in the early part of October, I think. There always is, but as you get. You know, further through the summer and there's less rain and precipitation in the mountains, it's usually less.
You just
it was a full
Yeah, you just don't think about that in San Diego or Southern California for that matter. The other one that had quite a bit of water flowing through it, although they had closed it off for a while, was up in Elfin Forest, up kind of south. I guess it's south of San Marcos.
Yeah, is that Escondido Creek?
I think so.
Yeah,
we hiked that a few years ago, and there was a lot of water going through there year round. They closed it for a while, and it was to prevent. I can't remember if it was to prevent some disease from spreading through. Might have been, I don't remember, but they closed it for a while. But it may be reopened now.
The oak gall is certainly not a problem, but one of the things people that they really need to be mindful of is to not move firewood around from place to place, because there is a pest that is unfortunately decimating local oaks, the golden oak shothole borer. And that is something I would treat. If I have a magnificent oak on a property, I would definitely treat, and you can use systemics, and you'd need an arborist that's qualified to do this. But if you've got beautiful oaks on your property, you could lose them to the golden oak shothole borer. So that would be something I would treat.
Yeah, when I think I mentioned it on the show a while back when we were back in Austin visiting some friends. They live in the hill country, and their property was covered with oak trees. And back there, there's I don't know if it's a Phytophthora or what, but there is a fungus that is killing oak trees in the hill country in Texas like crazy. And we pulled up to their house, and we looked around the property, and there's beer kegs laying all over their property. And I don't remember that the last time we were here. And the beer kegs were full of fungicide, and they were injecting it into the into the oak trees.
Wow.
And some of their neighbors had lost all of their mature oak trees to
it.
And apparently it spreads through the root system. And what people were doing is you could hire a trenching company to come in and cut a 10-foot deep trench all the way. How you do that without cutting through your sewer line and your water line, I don't know. Wow. But cut like a 10-foot deep trench all around your property, and it severs the root systems from your neighbor's oak trees and helps prevent the spread of the pathogen. Wow. But it was a big problem.
Up there. Same issue up at Central Coast, where the sudden oak death, which is a type of Phytophthora, I think it's Phytophthora remorum, if I remember.
I think you're right.
And that really travels via water. So it can spread as water flows. It just moves with the water, which is a scary prospect because we all need water and the trees need water.
And the trees need water, right?
Well, you know, talking about water and the spread of pathogens, I was just reading an article the other day about Hurricane Helene and what was it? Was it Milton? What was the other big hurricane that just went through back? I think it was Milton.
I think so, because it didn't sound very threatening.
Yeah. But they said that a lot of the citrus orchards they have to be really careful now that they've been saturated and there was standing water in the orchards, and it just opens the door for Phytophthora and several other diseases that they were very concerned about. That on top of having all of your structures to keep the psyllids off of your trees ripped away. Those hurricanes had a big impact on the citrus industry in the Southeast,
which has already been reeling from HLB.
They got an extra dose of it back there. Unfortunately, with that, going back again, before the break, we were talking about grapes and the grapes that my grandparents grew, and I actually went and looked it up, and it was Himrod. Which is it's not a big grape. I don't think they get any bigger than a dime.
No, they're small.
It's a relatively small grape. Excellent flavor. Seedless, I believe, too. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And especially, I know in Bay Park, they produced like crazy, just pounds and pounds of big bunches of grapes. So if you're looking for a nice, easy to grow, and my grandparents never pruned it. They just let it go. So it was all over the place.
Yeah. It's a pretty one. It turns like a yellow when it's fully ripe.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's
very golden looking.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So it's attractive just as a plant, even if you never harvest it. It's a good looking plant for a trellis.
I actually planted, speaking of gold, planted a couple of golden muskets along my back fence nice. when I when I put the house in. And they don't produce, well, now there's so much other stuff growing on them. You have to look to find them, but they still produce, and they produce huge grapes, right? They're about the size of a quarter, nice and golden when they're ripe. Very sweet. Mm-hmm. Very, very sweet.
I love Moscato.
It's gotta be cold.
It
is really good. But the biggest drawback we have to is they have seeds in them. So yeah, it's not, it doesn't make a great table grape, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. So anyway, when they do produce, the birds definitely enjoy them. We see them out there pecking away at them.
I've never been bothered by grape seeds. I just eat
the whole thing.
I eat the whole thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's like a pomegranate. Mm-hmm. Well, or maybe a kiwi, you know?
Well, yeah, I wouldn't know about the kiwi thing. As we are getting into fall, it is also time to start taking a look at what you're going to do with your lawn. I know my Bermuda lawn in the backyard has started to go dormant. The weeds in it are all still green. So that may be a good time to try to get out there and get rid of the stuff that's not Bermuda in it. My front lawn isn't Bermuda. I don't know. I actually don't know what it is, but it stays evergreen all year round. But for people that
it's not a fescue.
It was 27 years ago.
Okay.
It's not anymore. I don't know what it is now. Right. It almost looks like a cuyu.
Interesting.
It's kind of a running grass like that. But for those of you that have lawns that go dormant, now is the time to start thinking about overseeding your lawn. A lot of the golf courses do that down the fairways. As the lawns go dormant, you can put annual ryegrass down, which will germinate in
an hour.
I was gonna say a couple hours.
Less than a week with annual
so
rye.
It grows really fast, and it'll fill in your lawn, and you'll have a absolutely beautiful, lush green lawn until it starts to warm up again.
Yeah, until about March or so.
Yeah.
You know, the thing I always liked about annual rye when you're overseeding a typical, like a Claremont Bermuda lawn like I had, is that it's a lighter green. And in the winter when there's diminished light, it was very, very, it was like effervescent. It kind of has this glow to it that's beautiful.
It's really pretty.
And I actually enjoyed the winter lawn more than the summer lawn when I had a lawn at a house. And, you know, it's terrific. Plus, this is the time if you've had spots in your lawn, maybe your sprinklers don't cover so well, this is the time to tackle that. Get the sprinklers fixed so that you get head-to-head coverage. And then this is the time of year. November is the best month of the whole year to overseed. If you've got a fescue lawn, overseed with fescue seed, steer manure, and it'll bounce back and look great.
Yeah. A fescue lawn is, I've always liked the fescue the best. Because it's green all year round, and it's nice to run on barefoot. It's great to lay on. It's just a beautiful lawn. I know that it's a little bit more water intensive than, say, a Bermuda, but the fescue doesn't get into everything.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't end up in your flower beds, your fruit trees, and everything.
Well, most people find, at least in San Diego, you will end up with a Bermuda lawn, whether you like
it
or not.
Absolutely true.
And so there are ways that you can do with that. I know some people don't like chemicals, but if you want to retain that fescue lawn or the bluegrass lawn or that mixed blended lawn, there's a product called Turf Lawn Ester.
Big fan.
That you can spray over the top. It won't hurt your cool season lawn, but it'll kill off the Bermuda.
Yep. Yeah.
And all broadleaf weeds
and the broadleaf weeds.
Yeah. Just about everything else.
Yeah.
Great product.
You're listening to Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. We're going to take a quick break, and we're going to be back with more right after this.
There is more Garden Talk on the way. Welcome back to Garden Talk by Walter Anderson Nursery. Got a gardening question? Call 888-344-1170. 888-344-1170. Now, here's your hosts, Ken Anderson and George Allman.
As I'm strolling down the garden path,
good to see you once again. Hello, friend.
Hello,
this time of the year, if you have a lawn that goes dormant, it's typically going to be one of the running type grasses. In this area, it's usually Bermuda grass, or sometimes you'll see people that still have St. Augustine. Mm-hmm. Both of those grasses over the years will develop thatch, which is an undergrowth. Some of it's dead, some of it's still alive, but it's a thick mat that grows underneath the plant. It can cause water difficulties watering. It just takes up a lot of space and doesn't leave a lot of room for new growth on them. You can dethatch during the wintertime. Mm-hmm. There's a couple of ways you can get a power dethatcher to do it, or if you're just a masochist, you can get a dethatching rake.
It's good exercise.
I was going to go with the exercise angle,
it's a lot like work, dragging a dethatch, especially through a heavily thatched lawn. But it does make a big difference in it, and it allows new growth, and the lawn, when the weather warms up, it'll bounce back very quickly. And John, you said in the wintertime, you usually aerate.
I aerate twice a year. So I will aerate in the fall and then again in spring. Mm-hmm. And you want to aerate and thatch, of course, before you do any overseeding that you would want to do. And I would also do that prior to fertilization. And most people think in the wintertime, you don't need to fertilize. And that's actually not the truth. You need to fertilize. I still fertilize in winter, but maybe rather than about a 4-week cycle, I switch to maybe a 6-week cycle. But one important thing, winter lawn versus summer lawn. Summer lawn, you can use a fertilizer like a 16-6-8. Turf Supreme is probably my favorite. But what happens is that the bacteria in the soil that's extant in the biome breaks down that nitrogen into a nitrate form that can then be utilized by the lawn. And when it gets cool, those bacteria get sleepy and mm-hmm. they go dormant. And so you need to switch. Typically, I would switch November 1st to a cool season fertilizer. And you can find cool season fertilizers at a good nursery or at the Home Depot. You want to go with like a Banditti's all season fertilizer or Turf Royale. There are other formulations, but it has a split nitrogen ion out of the bag so that it's ready to be utilized. It's already in that nitrate form. And so you'll find that your lawn will look so much better if you're fertilizing, even in the wintertime.
Yeah.
But switch fertilizers.
Yeah. I know some of the aerating companies around San Diego, I don't hear about them much anymore, but they're
fewer
used to be
and fewer lawns. Fewer.
That's probably, yeah, there's the driver.
Well, that's
right
probably
there.
It right there. Yep. But after they would aerate, they would put pelletized gypsum down
and gypsum,
too.
Yeah.
To help keep the soil loose,
right.
And better draining.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and add calcium.
So if, like I said, if you have a lawn, these are things to consider this time of the year.
And by the way, I just want to say no lawn shaming here. Our climate really is not the best for lawns, but a little bit of lawn, or if you have a 6-year-old, I had 4 kids and I've got like 15 grandkids. They want a little lawn to play on.
Yeah.
And it's not the end of the world. It is not the unforgivable sin, may I say, to have a very beautiful, healthy lawn.
I have always felt that way.
And I as well. And I appreciate you saying that.
Yeah. And, you know, it's funny when it kind of reminds me of the conversation we had on a previous show about California natives. And there's a big push right now to plant California natives. I hear the advertisements for it all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And they keep talking about how the natives are water wise. But
not always.
We had a great discussion last time about that.
So, but that after that discussion, I hear that commercial on the radio now very mm-hmm. frequently, and they're I'm pretty sure it's the state is pushing natives, which I have no issue with natives, but they're not all drought tolerant.
They are pushing natives big time. There's actually pending now whether this will come to fruition or not. There is a proposal that in the county of San Diego, some localities are already doing this. City of Encinitas, they're talking about mandating that people need to put native plants in their home landscaping, which I'm sorry, can I say, I'm a liberal libertarian. So I do not like the government telling me every single thing I must do or what I cannot do. And I think that would be horrible for both the landscape industry, for the green industry. there's not even enough supply
for
to
the
have,
aesthetics.
You know, the aesthetics. There's nothing wrong with some very judiciously placed Australian, South African plants. And by the way, make sure that, you know, the native stuff can be augmented and be made beautiful by all these other very drought tolerant plants. So like you were saying, Ken, not every native is drought tolerant. Sometimes a choice from Western Australia or South Africa is a better choice than some natives. And so it's, I think it's too easy to generalize and say all natives are good, everything else is bad.
I agree. If the goal of your landscape is to use less water, there are a lot of options out there, and not all of them came, not all of them are from California. There's some very, like you said, South African, Australian plants as well. The other thing that I think some people forget is with a lot, when you, it doesn't matter what you plant, you've got to water it to get it established.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you really do. The other thing with some of the California natives that you might want to be aware of too, is that some of them tend to burn. And if you live in a fire area, you may want to reduce or at least judiciously plant those plants so that they are not, not that close to your house.
What I was going to say was the other thing that, you know, you talk about, if you're trying to make your yard use less water, you can still put plants that are a more water dependent plant with a lot of mulch, and you still can water once a week.
Yeah. Or hydrozone your yard so that you have, maybe you can indulge slightly and have
over
one area
here,
where I've got, you know, higher water use plants, whereas maybe 80% of the yard is very, very low. You know, that this is the beauty of designing a landscape so that you can hydrozone, you can make it interesting. It's kind of difficult too to find shade plants that are natives that are going to do well, or dry shade. That is a very difficult plant biome to install plants into. And so you just have to be creative, and you know, one size does not fit all.
Lawns basically need mostly nitrogen. Mm-hmm. That's what they grow the best off of. Mm-hmm. So there are sources of nitrogen out there that you can use on a lawn if you're concerned about it. Although I'm kind of one of those people that think if you use the product judiciously and carefully, you're not going to have any big issues with it. I know it's
with the
label. I think it's phosphate. I think is one of the big things that they have been concerned about environmentally lately.
Well, and phosphates persist for a very, very long time.
Yeah,
and you know, nitrogen, especially most sources that we're using, they are used up almost immediately. You know, sulfate of ammonia is water soluble. I mean, it is, you literally put that on, hit water, and it's almost gone.
Yeah.
Phosphates can be problematic. The other thing is, you know, if you're fertilizing your lawn, make sure you get, there's not always bad to use a leaf blower, by the way, as a person who is in commercial landscaping. It's so much more efficient and quick than using a broom. Well, blow all of the little prills back onto the lawn. Make sure that it's not on the sidewalk or in the gutter. Make sure everything blows back on so you're minimizing any runoff. And also, don't water your lawn to the point of runoff.
Yeah, that's
my
the big
golly.
One.
You know, I see sometimes somebody's watering for half an hour and the water's just running off like a creek. Can I give a little commercial landscape secret here?
Pretty quick.
Break up your water cycle on your irrigation timer. Water for 3 or 4 minutes till you just get before the point of runoff. Wait 30 minutes, do it again, and maybe 5 minutes, 6 minutes, and then maybe do it one more time. Instead of one 18-minute cycle, break it up into 3 cycles and allow that to perk down nicely into the lawn.
Yeah, that's what I've done at my house, and it's dramatically reduced the amount of water runoff that I had.
Well, and it's not just that the runoff is going to carry away your pesticides, fungicides, and fertilizer. You're wasting a ton of water that's not getting down into the roots.
Yeah.
Dormant spraying is right around the corner.
It is.
As things start to go dormant, or if it turns out to be a warm winter, which I think we have a La Nina this year, so I don't, I can never keep track of whether that means it's going to be a warm, dry winter or a cold, wet winter or a warm, wet winter or a warm, dry winter. It seems like every time they announce that it's going to come up, it seems to change as to what it's going to do. And now I don't even remember what I was talking about.
Dormant spring.
Dormant spring. So if it does turn out to be warm and the plants don't go completely dormant before it's time to dormant spray, go ahead and dormant spray. They'll go dormant. It'll usually knock the foliage off of them at that point.
That is one of the tasks in the garden too that I find is far too easy to procrastinate on. Mm-hmm. And you think, oh, I'll wait, or it's going to rain. And the next thing you know, and really you should spray as soon as all your leaves drop. That's the first opportunity to get it done. As soon as all the leaves fall, start your dormant spraying, because it's so easy to procrastinate. And then, you know, a month or 6 weeks has gone by and you've missed an opportunity. And really you want to do three times.
Ideally.
Well, if I may, for clarity, when you say dormant spray, are we talking about the horticultural oil or the fungicides?
Both.
Well, both. Okay. Yeah. And you can mix both. It's convenient for certain to mix both. And there are certain products that you can mix both the oil spray and the copper oil or,
Liquid cop, if you do the Monterey, for example, you can make those mix.
Those do mix. Yeah. You have to be careful. Not all do, but as long as you're careful about reading your label, you can mix them and save a little time.
Yeah, back in the day, it was lime sulfur and Volk oil.
Oh, my goodness. And remember how bad lime sulfur smelled?
Oh, it was terrible.
Oh, it was nasty stuff. It was
really bad.
That goes to your point when you said if the leaves haven't fallen yet, you can spray and they will fall. They don't fall if you do copper. And they don't fall if you do hort oil.
Well, hort oil, no. Right.
Or daconil.
Or, yeah, any of those, they don't fall. Yeah. But with lime sulfur, when you did it, defoliated your trees.
Yeah, that was the end of the foliage. The other thing too during dormant spraying season, clean up all the old foliage, especially peach trees and nectarines and things like that.
And roses in the
prunus family. Yeah. Get all of that out of there, because that's going to take a lot of the fungus spores that fell out of the tree away from the tree. And don't put it in your compost pile either. Throw it away. Put it in your green recycling bin and get rid of it.
Same situation with petal blight on camellias. If you leave your infected old spent blooms from your camellias on the ground, that will just perpetually infect your soil. And so it splashes back up. So one of the things I like to do is make sure I'm very tidy about removing any infected blossoms. And then I'll put a fresh layer of mulch down every time so that then I'm reducing
encapsulate that. Yeah. Yeah. Since I don't have camellias in my yard anymore, that's one thing I haven't had to deal with, but it can be very frustrating.
Yeah. You have beautiful blooms and they just turn brown and
fall off. Which actually camellias and azaleas, well, camellias should be, they're starting to bud up now.
They are.
Some of them are plumping up. We have two. One of them is flowering right now. It's an apple blossom.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. When we were in Northern California, the Sasanquas were starting to bloom.
Yeah, Sasanquas are budded up nicely now and some are starting to bloom here.
Yeah. It's going to be about that time. You're listening to Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. We're going to take a quick break and we're going to be back with more right after this.
There is more Garden Talk on the way. Welcome back to Garden Talk by Walter Anderson Nursery. Got a gardening question? Call 888-344-1170. 888-344-1170. Now, here's your hosts, Ken Anderson and George Allman.
You know, we touched on earlier in the last segment, dormant spraying, and along with dormant spraying comes your pruning of roses and fruit trees and everything else. So the other thing that you need to cut back, or you should cut back this time of the year, if you haven't done it yet, is cut back your tropical milkweed. It reduces the amount of the protozoa, the OE. I can't remember what it stands for.
It is a protozoa.
And the
disease is OE.
The disease is OE. So, you know, it reduces that instance. It encourages the monarchs to move on in what their normal migration would be. Doesn't have them stick around. There was a very interesting article that came out in October. From the Texas Butterfly Ranch, which, if you have an interest in monarch butterflies, I find their research and their articles and the information that they have to be some of the most interesting, and I think some of the best that's out there. In some ways, it it kind of bucks what the more mainstream people are saying. But I find it all of the information that they have is written by people that, from what I see, look like they know what they're doing. From very, very good entomologists, and that. But one of the article that I had seen was, monarch migration may be at risk, the butterflies themselves are not. And for whatever reason, whether it's climate change, influence of expansion of civilization into their habitats, planting tropical milkweed along in other areas, the monarch populations themselves don't appear to be endangered, but their flights every year, their migration patterns are dwindling. And they said some of that is because they're evolving. They're adapting to what's the new normal. And I found that very interesting that they're changing, and you may lose the migration, or you're going to lose some of the migration, but they're realizing that why go through this horrendously difficult and usually deadly migration when they can just hang out where they're at and live their best life.
So instead of migrations, they're doing staycations.
I guess that's what it is.
They raise the kids in San Diego, so they stay.
And if I were a monarch butterfly, I don't think I could find a better place to be than Pacific Grove, which was sort of the terminal point for the big migration from Mexico up to Central Coast. If I could just stay at Carmel year round, I think I'd do that.
There's worse places that you could be. They did have an interesting map that showed some of the migrations north, and there was most of it's in the Midwest, with only just a couple of spots in California.
So, well, I think one of the things that, I think we forget sometimes that humans are a part of the ecosystem too.
Mm-hmm.
We are altering many things by our presence, by the disruption of native habitats and natural areas. In Southern California, my goodness, everything's getting paved over. But one of the things we are doing that's beneficial, I think, is that people are bearing in mind that they can plant to sustain butterflies. Mm-hmm. So people in their home gardens now are planting various kinds of milkweeds, even native milkweeds and fennel and, just so many beautiful plants in their garden that they can nourish these butterflies with. And I think that that's probably affecting some of the migration patterns too, is that there's a good food supply all the time now.
They don't have to travel to eat.
There really is. We have a fairly big section of our yard that's planted specifically for butterflies. And the biggest problem that I have with monarchs, which I absolutely love, and we had native milkweed, we had tropical milkweed growing in there specifically for the monarchs. But I think I'm going to take most of the milkweeds out. I'll leave the other plants there for the monarchs to feed on, because they will feed on other flowers other than milkweed, but they'll only lay their eggs on milkweed.
Right.
The problem that I have is that I've had tachinid flies invade my yard.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think I had one monarch complete its life cycle in my yard. And we had lots of chrysalis, but the tachinid flies are parasitizing them. Mm. So I think I'm going to take the milkweed out, at least for this season.
Mm.
And hopefully the monarchs will still come and feed on all the other salvias and everything else that we have there, but they won't breed in my yard. And hopefully after a season or maybe two of not hosting them for reproduction, the tachinid fly population will drop off or disappear, because they won't have anything to.
So what you're saying is you'd rather have butterflies than flies.
Than tachinid flies. It's so disappointing, because we would spot the chrysalis all over the yard, because they never metamorphose on anything else,
your lawn chair, on a bucket, on the milkweed.
But not on milkweed. Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So they're all over they're all around the milkweed. They're everywhere. Mm-hmm. But we would see one pop up, and then a few days later it was black.
Yeah.
You could see the hole in it where the fly or the larva that had already been ingested by it or whatever had come out. So, I'm going to try to reduce the tagging flies in the area just to keep it going.
One of the more common questions, in our group on Facebook, San Diego Gardener, which I think we're up to 21,000 people now of only San Diego residents, which is mind boggling to me. But one of the more common questions is the larva for the giant swallowtail butterflies. Mm-hmm. People tend to, can I say this? If you're unsure what it is, leave it in situ. Don't take it off, because people will take pictures and say, oh, look what I took off of my citrus tree. What is it? And then it's like, why did you disrupt the poor little thing?
Yeah.
And they call, that's called the bird poop.
Yeah.
Caterpillar.
Because that's what it looks like.
Right. It looks like bird poop. And it makes, though, the most beautiful giant, it's a giant swallowtail butterfly, black and yellow. They're spectacular. And if you see those, don't take them off your citrus. They will not denude your citrus tree.
They don't.
Very little. And they will do zero harm. And they're spectacularly beautiful.
We will take them when we find them here on the nursery stock. We'll take them out to our larger citrus out front so that they can continue on their journey.
It's not like when they're not as prolific in reproduction like monarchs are. Monarchs are voracious. Mm-hmm. They will absolutely wipe out milkweed. And it seems like the bigger the milkweed plant, the more eggs they lay. Mm-hmm. So the faster it gets wiped out.
It's denuded.
But that's not going to happen with the swallowtail. So if you do come across a swallowtail, like you said, my advice also would be just let it go. It's not going to cause any major damage.
But there are two types of swallowtails out here. That one is the giant. Then the other one that feeds on the anise, the fennel, parsley, and dill.
Dill.
Right.
Yep. So I think isn't it anise swallowtail?
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, it is.
It's gorgeous. Yeah.
That's where we used to see them. There was a lot of anise growing in Bay Park. A lot of the neighborhoods had dirt alleyways in between.
We called it wild licorice when we were kids.
Exactly.
Wasn't it wild fennel though?
Yeah, it is.
It was all over the place. Mm-hmm. All over the place. And there was, I remember riding our bikes up and down the alleys, and there was always swallowtails around, and always larvae in the
I would move them from my parsley and go put them on the wild fennel that was growing as weeds everywhere.
Another terrific butterfly for our area that's easy to attract to your garden is the Gulf fritillary. Mm-hmm. And all you need to do is plant some passion vine, and you'll have more Gulf fritillaries than you know what to do with. And by the way, passion vine grows so fast, there's no way they're going to do any harm. You're going to get more than enough passion fruit. But
caterpillars.
They are ugly, but a beautiful butterfly.
Gorgeous butterfly.
Well, it's funny. You talk about the passion vines and butterflies. I think it's in Boynton Beach, Florida. There is a butterfly conservatory. We went there a long time, 17, 18 years ago, when we were back visiting family. It's a huge conservatory, and it's almost all open air because of the climate. So they have the bug screening, and it's a USDA certified insectarium, I guess you would call it. But the guy that started it, his passion in plants was passion vines. Mm. And he actually wrote a book about passion vines. It's about an inch thick. And throughout the enclosure, he has passion vines from all over the world in various different flower forms. And it's really quite something to see when you get back there. If you like passion vines, that should be a must do on your vacation list, is to go and check that out.
I remember you speaking of it last time or when you came back rather, but I have a question. When you said passion vine, I have regular Passiflora edulis and then the Cerulea. Mm-hmm. I've never had a Gulf fritillary go to the edulis.
That's true.
Yeah. But they love the others.
They do.
Yeah. I've never had them.
And the Fredericks. There's a few others they really like, but you're correct.
Yeah. Any of the real edible ones, I've not had a problem with them eating it, but they will devour the others.
The passion vines, it reminds me of an article I wrote a number of years ago that I published online about a fellow in Pacific Beach named Kuhlman. He was a doctor, a former missionary, and he came to Pacific Beach down on Hornblende Street, and he had a giant passion vine farm. and then up onto Mount Soledad. And he made a ton of money raising passion vine here in San Diego, maybe in the 1920s.
Oh, interesting.
Very, I'll have to republish.
I'll have to look at that.
Yeah, I'd love to see that. Yeah, very interesting.
You've been listening to Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. I'm Ken Anderson along with George Hallman and John Clements. We'll be back next week with another hour of Garden Talk. Have a great weekend, everybody.
Thank you for joining us on Garden Talk by Walter Anderson Nursery, your source for gardening, landscaping, and horticultural news. Still have a question for the Garden Talk crew or want to learn more about the show or how to become a guest or sponsor? Send an email to gardentalkradio@walteranderson.com. That's gardentalkradio@walteranderson.com or visit walteranderson.com. There's more professional gardening advice next week at the same time on Garden Talk by Walter Anderson Nursery.